KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Washington.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. State lawmakers still have not reached a budget agreement. We're going to get a legislative update coming up in the next hour. President Obama is making his first extended trip to Africa this week. He's brought an entourage of trade officials and U.S. business people along with him. Some observers believe this trip is designed to counter China's massive investment across the African subcontinent. Whitney Schneidman is a non-resident fellow with the Africa Growth Initiative. He's a member of the Trade Advisory Committee on Africa in the U.S. in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. I asked Mr. Schneidman why the Obama administration had not paid much attention to Africa before now.
I think that the reason for it is they were focused on other issues, and I think the president would, he said as much. They're focused on extracting the U.S. from Afghanistan and Iraq and obviously stabilizing the economy. And then there were political realities. When you have sort of this movement of folks questioning where the president was born, that was, you know, that was a constraint as well. But I think that there was a real sense that the president wanted to do more on Africa in the second term, and I think this trip to the continent is a demonstration of that.
The president is visiting three countries, correct?
That's right.
And these are Senegal, South Africa, and Tanzania?
That's correct.
How were they chosen?
They're chosen on the strength of their commitment to democracy. I think the potential that they have for investment, being representative of their regions. So these are the factors that go into these kinds of decisions.
I know that the president has sort of three main themes. You mentioned these three countries were chosen for democracy. That's one of his themes. But the other is economic development. And As I understand it, the sort of overarching nature of this trip is less about humanitarian aid and more about business partnerships.
That's correct, and I think that's as it should be, because Africa has 7 of the 10 fastest-growing economies in the world, and governance has improved dramatically over the last 20 years. And I think there's a real sense that Africa's on the move and American companies haven't really woken up to that, where you have companies from China and Brazil and India and the EU. U.S. companies aren't very represented there. So I think there's a sense that the administration wants to bring more attention to the African market and wants to put in place programs that will help U.S. companies capture these opportunities.
You mentioned China, and as I read it, the Chinese investment in Africa overall is about 3 times what U.S. investment is. Am I reading that correctly?
Well, the commercial relationship between China and Africa is twice what the U.S. relationship is. China has about a $200 billion trading relationship. The U.S. has about a $100 billion.
And are the Chinese investments in particular countries, or is it sort of evenly spread across the continent?
It's all over sub-Saharan Africa.
What kind of impact does that investment have politically for China?
It has a positive impact. The Chinese have played their hand pretty astutely on the continent, and they've invested primarily in the infrastructure, although not exclusively, but a lot in the infrastructure area. And they've, since they're state-owned companies and they don't have stockholders, they don't have boards of directors to whom they're responsible, they can make decisions a lot more quickly, and they can, they're a lot more flexible on their terms. So they have generated a lot of support among African governments for their investments.
You mentioned when we started the conversation that one political reason that the president maybe didn't visit Africa during the first term was the continued accusation that he wasn't born in the United States, that in fact he was born in Africa. We've said that in the past, but I'm wondering, despite the fact that the president hasn't really spent much time in the African continent, does that lower the public opinion of him vis-a-vis China?
I think people are waiting to see what Obama's legacy in Africa is going to be. You know, Bill Clinton had a very positive legacy with the African Growth and Opportunity Act. George Bush had a very popular legacy through PEPFAR and the creation of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. So I think everybody's waiting to see, you know, what is Obama going to do on the continent? And expectations were extraordinarily high when he got elected, and they've been tempered some since then. There's no question about that. So I think this trip will be important to beginning to construct that legacy.
Now, the president chose these three countries that you mentioned have the most developed democracies, particularly South Africa. He's visiting Robben's Island, but he's also visiting at a time that Nelson Mandela is in very critical condition. So what does that mean for the timing of this trip? Does it have any impact at all?
Well, it could. It could have a significant impact. But I think that, you know, these trips are planned long in advance. A lot of work and a lot of planning goes into it. So some things you just cannot foresee. But I think that in the fact that President Obama is the first elected African-American leader, and Nelson Mandela was the first democratically elected African leader of South Africa. I mean, these are very powerful symbols that have been intermingled over the last several years. And it's quite a poignant moment. There's no question about that.
The other question I had to do with these are three countries that the president will visit out of many on the African subcontinent. And some of them are quite unstable politically. There are there's a lot of talk about Islamic jihadists. There's violence that has nothing to do with that, but has to do with things like diamonds or oil control. I think it's, for many Americans, Africa is still a very much an unknown. So we don't think about, I mean, we hear these stories and we think, oh, pirates or, you know, jihadists or diamonds. And we don't think about, you know, what it means to invest in that continent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what notion should we be disabused of, I guess, is what I'm asking you.
Right. I think the a common perception among many Americans of Africa is that it's a continent of conflict, a continent in crisis, a continent of disease and corruption. When in reality, it's a continent of opportunity. It's a continent of growing consumers. It's a continent of growing accountability. And it's a continent where people are succeeding in getting ahead. And by that, I mean people have discretionary income through their private sector or public sector jobs, and they're investing in their children's educations. They're investing in mortgages to buy homes. They're investing, you know, in cars and car payments. And they're investing in services. One of the fastest growing sector in Africa is the services sector. And so the continent is really one of very dynamic and rapid change. And I think the president really wants to convey that back to the United States in his travels. And he wants to position American companies to take advantage of that growing consumer strength and the opportunities that are generated from that.
I know that there's an entourage of business leaders that are going. How many will come with the president?
Well, there's going to be a business roundtable in South Africa, and he is taking the head of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. He's taking the head of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. He's taking Mike Froman, who was recently confirmed as U.S. Trade Representative. So that's really his economic leadership team in many respects. There's going to be a CEO summit in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, where there will be some 100 CEOs from U.S. And African companies. So there's going to be a real effort to not just initiate a dialogue on trade and investment and commerce, but to really identify strategies for American companies to get more involved in this emerging continent of opportunity.
Do we have any particular trade policies in place with Africa? We do. We have NAFTA, for example, for the American two American continents. But what is our official stance or policy set?
We do. The cornerstone of our commercial engagement with Africa is something called the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And this was passed in 2000 and signed by President Clinton. And what this did is it dropped to zero the duties and tariffs on some 4,600 products coming from Africa. So it really tried to use trade as a stimulus for economic development. So I think what President Obama wants to do is to build on the African Growth and Opportunity Act and look to see how we can develop more mature and more sophisticated trading relationships so that we can engage the East African region of some 130 million people that make up Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania, and that we can engage the market of West Africa, Nigeria and Ghana and Senegal, some 250 million people. So, you know, these markets become quite important areas for us to do business in.
Realistically, after summits are held and initial relationships are formed, how long does or might it take until any kind of real investment happens?
Well, I think we're already seeing real investment from companies like Walmart invested in Africa, GE's invested there, Procter & Gamble's invested there, and I think that will increase in the coming years. And the strategies that President Obama puts in place on this trip, I think, will be important to that. So I'm expecting that we'll see a steady increase. Our exports, for example, to Africa, currently about $23 billion a year, and that's been growing pretty steadily between 5 and 10% per year. And translated into U.S. jobs, that $23 billion supports about 100,000 jobs here in the United States. So increasingly, our relationship with the continent is changing to one where it is one of mutual gain and mutual benefit. And I think the challenge is, how do we deepen that and how do we do that relatively quickly?
And finally, the last of the president's main themes is youth. I know he's going to be addressing a youth group, I think a university group in South Africa. But how does that dovetail with the trade?
Well, on the African continent, there are nearly 1 billion people. And the median age of those 1 billion people is 17.
Oh, my gosh.
So the president, in his youth initiative, is trying to develop a program to engage the next generation of African leaders, the next generation of African entrepreneurs, the next generation of journalists and jurists and others, in such a way that he helps them realize the opportunities that maybe their parents haven't had. So it's called the Young Africa Leader Initiative, is really something that's very close to the president's heart. And he has brought together a very interesting group of U.S. companies and universities and non-governmental organizations to work together to help make this initiative a dynamic reality.
It sounds a bit like an exhausting trip, I have to say. How will the Obama administration judge if the whole thing is a success?
Well, I think you've got near-term and long-term, and what matters to me is the long-term. And as you said, you know, will we see our investment grow 10 and 20% per year over the next 5 to 10 years? Will we see U.S. companies and U.S. universities engaging several thousand of these youth leaders that come through this program? Will we see our exports continuing to grow at 10 and 15% even? These are the kind of indicators that will really judge the success, and I think that are really important and the ones to keep focused on.
Whitney Schneidman's a non-resident fellow with the Africa Growth Initiative. He's a member of the Trade Advisory Committee on Africa in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. President Obama is currently in Senegal on his week-long Africa trip. This is Weekday.
It's 9:22. A tale of two Queensryches in a minute.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
65 degrees in Seattle, cloudy with scattered showers. Forecast says we're going to see a mix today of a little bit of sun, a little bit of rain here and there, and a high of 72. And then starting tomorrow on Friday, we're looking at mostly sunny days and temperatures in the upper 70s to low 80s all the way through Wednesday. It's 9:23. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A conversation about the rights of transgender people in 10 minutes.
Don't bang your head against the wall. This is Weekday on KUOW. Fans of the Seattle area band Queensryche have a lot to be psyched about this week. A brand new album and two live shows. They performed last night at the Crocodile. The band performs again this Saturday night at the Moore Theater. Problem, it's actually two different bands, both of them using the name Queensryche. Following a huge fight last summer, the band split in two, one faction with lead singer Jeff Tate, the other with the founding guitarist, bass player, and drummer. A judge will rule in November how the name and logo can be used, but until then, both versions of Queensryche are touring, both releasing albums. So what the heck is going on? To help us sort all this out is Albert Moudrian. He's editor-in-chief at Decibel Magazine. Albert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me start with the basics. When was the heyday of the first Queensryche?
Now, the heyday of the first Queensryche is probably a little bit after that snippet of Queensryche that you guys introduced a moment ago. The heyday is probably 1988 to 1990, 1991 or so, where they had a consecutive streak of three platinum albums in a row. But since then, I'd say, you know, in the past 20 years or so, Queensryche's relevance has waned considerably.
Well, and I assume that that all sort of coincided with the rise of the so-called grunge movement in Seattle?
Yeah, you know, Seattle is responsible for bringing us Queensryche, I guess, and partially responsible for taking Queensryche away from the rest of the world in some way. But I do think that, that did have something to do, that rise of grunge in the early 90s, that obviously had something to do with their wane in popularity. But, you know, can't blame everything on Kurt Cobain.
Okay. Well, so they kept touring, though, despite being overshadowed. Why did they split into these two factions, these two Queensryches?
Well, it's kind of a long story that's been told many, many times, unfortunately, in the heavy metal world, where you bring in management that is somehow part of the family of one of the bands. In Queensryche's case, it was the wife of one of the members. I believe it was Jeff Tate's wife,
right,
in fact, who was
right,
managing the band. And that, in the history of heavy metal, has caused a lot of problems, whether it was with bands like Pantera or Sepultura or even Black Sabbath having somebody who is the wife or the mother or father of one of the members managing a band, seems to eventually create a rift. And in that case, it created a significant rift to where once the band decided that they didn't want to work with Jeff's wife and I believe it was his daughter also anymore. They split into two camps, both attempting to use the name Queensryche.
Well, so now we have two Queensryche. Who are our diehard Queensryche fans siding with?
Well, you know, it's pretty split, but my guess is that the hearts are probably with Michael Wilton's Queensryche, who is the founding guitarist, that it would be the non-Jeff Tate version of Queensryche, simply because he was, you know, definitely more instrumental in songwriting. And for a lot of people, that version of Queensryche that he's in is probably more traditional heavy metal, whereas the Jeff Tate-fronted version of Queensryche, while, you know, he is the fellow providing the vocals that are distinctive, that everybody remembers, the new material maybe isn't quite all that heavy metal anymore.
Well, so Decibel Magazine reviewed both Queensryche releases, both new releases. You talked about how one is more metal than the other, but musically, what did you think?
I guess metal only gets you so far. I guess you'd have to say that without the songs, it really doesn't matter what the context is, what the genre or subgenre they're performing in. Both records are kind of underwhelming, honestly, though I do agree with our reviewer's perspective that the Michael Wilton Queensryche is probably a little bit more palatable than the Jeff Tate Queensryche.
You mentioned that often you've seen sort of a family member get involved and then in the management of the band, and that splits the band. But have you heard of any other occasions where a split has found its way into the courts?
There have been, on a much lesser scale. There's a Norwegian black metal band called Gorgoroth, who split into two Gorgoroths around 2006 or 2007, and that was also a very public and contentious lawsuit that was brought out, and eventually they had to settle with there being one Gorgoroth and another Gorgoroth having to change their name and soldier on, although there are rumors that they are basically reforming as Gorgoroth altogether, big happy black metal family. Beautiful story.
Well, that's nice that there's a happy ending. Black metal doesn't sound like a music.
There usually aren't many happy endings in black metal. Yeah. This is a rare occasion.
I was just thinking that. Well, you're not the judge. Maybe that's a good thing. That judge has till November to decide who gets the name, who gets the logo. But, you know, just from your gut reaction, Albert, who do you think should get the rights to the brand?
I think it's a pretty simple solution. I think what the judge needs to do is to take the Y in Queensryche that contains the umlaut, the very important heavy metal umlaut over the Y, and give one Queensryche the left dot in the umlaut and the other Queensryche the right dot in the umlaut, and they can both soldier on with the name Queensryche, but obviously as two distinctive Queensryche.
That sounds like a very Solomon-like decision. Split that baby. Albert Mudrian is editor-in-chief at Decibel Magazine. Albert, thank you so much for trying to clarify the dueling Queensryche situation.
It's my pleasure. Hopefully we can get this resolved as soon as possible.
And a little more of the original Queensryche to take us out here on Weekday on KUOW.
The music of Queensryche. It's 9:30. Conversation about the rights of transgender people in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
On the next Fresh Air, how being African in America compares with being African-American. We talk with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie about her new semi-autobiographical novel, Americana. Growing up in Nigeria, she wasn't defined by her race. When she came to America to attend college, she found herself in the middle of racial conflicts she didn't even understand. Join us.
You can hear that tonight at 8 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. It's on HD radio, and it's online at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Pure, a member-owned insurer for responsible, high-net-worth families, offering expertise and resources to help prevent claims and resolve them without hassle when they happen. Learn more at pureinsurance.com.
65 degrees in Seattle, on our way to a high today of 72, anticipating partly sunny skies with showers mixed in. Tomorrow, Friday, it's going to be mostly sunny, getting up into the 80s. 9:32, I'm Bernard Ouellette. An update on what state lawmakers are up to as they continue to try to hammer out a budget in 35 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. It was good news for same-sex couples who are legally wed in Washington. They'll now have access to the same federal legal protections that married heterosexuals get, and it's likely going to be cause of celebration at this weekend's Pride festivities. The annual Pride Parade celebrates the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered community, but this year, we're going to see something a little bit different. The transgender community is staging its own march tomorrow. And that leads us to a string of questions. Why a solo parade? What does it mean to be transgendered? How big is the transgender community? And what issues face them? And joining us to help answer some of these questions, maybe all of them, is Daniela Schini. She's executive director of the Gender Justice League. And that Gender Justice League are the organizers of the Trans Pride March tomorrow. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Also here is Spencer Bergstad, who's a Seattle lawyer, and you're going to be speaking at the rally tomorrow?
I am.
Okay. Well, I guess I need to walk us back and talk parameters here. And it's the very basic question. Transgender is a broad group of a community. So are there parameters? Is there a definition?
Sure. It's a really good question. So we generally talk about transgender people as people who experience their gender in a way that is considered nonconforming from traditional gender norms. So people who maybe are born one sex and then identify internally or experience their life or gender as something other than that which we attribute with what they're born as.
And does that involve necessarily a sexual reassignment surgery?
It doesn't. So it's pretty broad. So there are people that are transsexual or who undergo medical interventions, either surgery or hormones, and those folks we typically have said are transsexual. But then more broadly, a number of people who, because of things like health insurance exclusions, are unable to access medical interventions, who still identify as transgender or genderqueer or gender nonconforming. There's a lot of different labels and terminologies that are used.
A lot of labels and terminologies. And for those of us who are on the outside of that community, it's a little bit hard to grasp, you know, what do you say? Who are we talking about? Spencer, how large a community lives in the central Puget Sound region?
Probably a pretty large community. One of the things that we're blessed with here in the Puget Sound is that we have a long history of tolerance and inclusion and legal protection, which I think has made particularly the greater Seattle area somewhat of a mecca over really since 1973, when the first anti-discrimination laws in the city of Seattle included trans people in their umbrella. So, you know, overall, statistically, in the United States, we're looking at maybe 700,000 people. In terms of how many of those folks are here in the area, I think that's a harder number to pin down. But what I would say is that we have comparatively a large population of trans-identified people here.
So we, with yesterday's DOMA decision, we see more and more acceptance of gay men and lesbians, making it perhaps easier to come out and identify yourself that way. Is it as easy to come out and identify yourself as transgender?
I would say I think it's a little bit more challenging still. There have been, as Spencer has pointed out, really amazing legal gains here in Washington State and incredible work that's been done. Ingersoll Gender Center, which exists on Capitol Hill, has been here for 35 years, is one of the oldest trans organizations in the country, maybe even the world. And so I think there's a lot of support here. But I still think, based off of the numbers that we know from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey, that a large percentage of people who come out are rejected from from their family. Almost 55% of people, with only about 45% of their respondents being accepted by their family.
Was that true for you?
You know, my family was very accepting when I came out. I transitioned in high school in Maine in a very rural environment.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I had great parents. But in my school and community, it was exceptionally difficult. I was the victim of hate crimes. My family was forced to move to a larger city where they felt like I could be more safe. And so for me personally, it was an amazing and accepting family, but a community that really rejected me.
When did you know that you were a female?
Yeah, it's really a good question. It's really hard to pin down that answer. I think it was a conclusion that I came to over a period of time around between 11 and 14. And there just are not very many cultural images that make transition a possibility. We don't see a lot of characters on television where we hear this narrative. And so as a young person, it didn't seem like a possibility until I started to see more cultural images in movies and television, and then started to really question my gender, and I had really amazing parents who helped me figure that out.
We're talking with Danielle Eschini, also with us, Spencer Bergstad, and you were a little bit older when you transitioned.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do have a few years on Danielle, so in fact, I just turned 50, so for me, growing up in the 60s and 70s, there really were no images at all. I mean, the only people that I remember even hearing about as a young person were Christine Jorgensen and Renee Richards, and Renee in part because I was a big tennis fan at the mm-hmm. time. But there were no images of trans men. And so that did not at all seem like a possibility for me. And so it wasn't until I was in my late 20s, early 30s that I started to meet other trans men. And that then gave me the tools with which to really live a fully actualized life and to be true to myself.
Where were you?
I was here in Seattle.
Oh, you were here. So in this liberal bastion, you weren't in a rural area.
No, not at all. I mean, through junior high and high school, I was in a very rural area in Minnesota, which was a very uncomfortable place to be. Someone who was very masculine in appearance and expression, was very clearly attracted to women. And in a small town in Minnesota in the 70s, that was not a comfortable or safe place to be.
We're joined now on the phone by Carolyn McGregor, I believe. Are you with us?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. And yes. Carolyn, you have an 11-year-old tween who is a transgendered, very young person. And I'm curious, listening to Danielle and Spencer talk, when did you know your child felt like a girl and is a girl?
Yeah, well, my child started expressing a desire to dress like a girl when she was about 4. And we basically, her dad and I, supported her. It kind of made sense looking back earlier in her life. She's always played with girls, always, you know, just clicked more with girls, always had a preference for things that were pretty. She's not the typical transgender child in that she really has a lot of preferences that are, you know, what we would say stereotypically male preferences. But she also just resonates better with females, and that's who she feels herself to be. And she spent a number of years identifying as male, but expressing herself and presenting as a female. And those were confusing years for the rest of the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly had to do a lot of education. But after kind of living in that in-between place for about 5 years, she decided in fourth grade that she really did feel like she was all female, and she wanted to make that full social transition to live as a girl.
You mentioned the stereotypical, and Danielle Eschini, it doesn't sound like there is any one path in this community that is so varied.
Certainly. I mean, and I think if we think about gender more broadly, for women, it would be unrealistic for us to say that, like, all women present their gender in a particular way. And so I think for many trans people, it's very similar, right? So mm-hmm. it's important not to project our sense that, like, if you identify as a woman, you have to have one particular behavior. And so that's no different for trans people.
Yeah,
we live in a very complex gender world. So, yeah, I'd say that that's very true.
And
so,
I think that we have to remember, too, that gender identity, that sense of self, of who you are as male or female or either or both or neither, is very different than your gender expression, which falls on a range of masculine to feminine. And so any of us, regardless of how we identify our gender identity, can fall anywhere on that range of gender expression.
So, Carolyn McGregor, I know that you and your daughter are going to be taking part in tomorrow's Trans Pride March, right?
That's correct.
And I wonder how you found your way to the Gender Justice League or to this movement in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the Gender Justice League, I actually found out through a friend who is in the family support group that I belong to that meets at Children's Hospital here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So she told me about this new event and this group that she's become a part of. But with just transgender resources for transgender children, I found out about it through, initially, many years ago, through a national listserv that came out of Washington, D.C., the Children's Hospital there. And then I found out about the Gender Odyssey Conference for families that takes place here in Seattle every summer. And through that, the children's support group, or the family support group, actually started the year following that first family conference. And so since then, I've been fairly hooked into the local support resources for families and kind of have the national movement or network in my radar, just because, you know, once you're in, everyone helps everyone else stay informed. So it becomes a pretty tight circle once you've found the resources in the first place.
It's so interesting. I introduced this whole segment by talking about LGBT. It struck me when I was thinking about it, Danielle, why was the T part of L, G, and B?
That's a really good question. Spencer might actually
be able to answer that for me.
Well, I think, you know, even if you go back to the origins of what we can call the modern sort of queer movement and Stonewall was really the result of drag queens who certainly fall within the rubric of the transgender community. Butch Dykes, who often fall within the rubric of the transgender community as being female-bodied people with a very masculine gender expression. So really the origins of what we call the modern gay rights movement really fall much on the shoulders of and heels of the trans community. What's interesting is that I think that the trans community was very much left out for a long time. Certainly even within the gay and lesbian community, there's a fair amount of transphobia. And one of the things that I think is true about that is that for trans people, we, in many ways, are more visible in our difference than the average gay man or lesbian might be. And so that visibility can cause discomfort for people who don't want to necessarily be so visible.
Huh.
And so I think that there was a fair amount of wanting to exclude trans people for a long time. And it wasn't really until I think probably I would say the mid-90s that the larger national organizations and really initially through the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which is now I think just really called the Task Force. and its former executive director, Carrie LaBelle, that really said, you know what, no, the trans community is included. We have to include them. We have to include them in our language. And to leave them out, it does a disservice to all of us.
Spencer Burke says with us, and Danielle Eschini, this march tomorrow is the first time that the transgender community has really held its own pride-related but separate event. What was the reason that you thought, oh, we've got to do our own thing?
Well, actually, there was another pride event in 1997 that was at. There was, yeah.
Yeah, we organized one in 1997.
Yeah. So
was it successful?
Yeah. I mean, it was quite a bit smaller than I think what we're expecting for tomorrow.
Yeah.
But certainly it fed on... obviously, that was the year after DOMA was passed, so there was a lot of interest. And it was also on the heels of we had had a F2M conference of the Americas here in Seattle in 1996. So
that
it really followed
female to male.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it followed on the heels of that, and so we had sort of some momentum at that time. But then it sort of dissipated, and I'm glad that the Gender Justice League has brought it back this year.
So this year's. Let's just talk about the sure. origins of this year's.
Yeah, so I think that this year's, I mean, it really comes on the heels of such huge gains, both here in Washington State and nationally. And there's really, I would say, a new wave of trans activism that has started to spring up in the last 7 to 10 years within the trans community, of recognizing that while being in the LGBT community, having a trans autonomous movement that's really led by and for trans mm-hmm. folks helps to elevate a number of the different issues that we're facing.
So what are some of those that are specific to transgender people?
Sure. So I think like healthcare exclusions and health insurance policies is a really big issue in the city of Seattle. I think a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, it removed their exclusions in city policy for all city employees. So health insurance exclusions is one. Certainly issues of homelessness and housing is huge in the trans community because homeless services are segregated by gender. And so that's an issue that I think is really specific for trans people. And we know that about 17% of trans people have experienced homelessness at some point in their lives. So there's a number of issues that sort of elevate to a really intense level for us.
Well, Spencer, since you're an attorney, I have mm-hmm. to ask you this question. As I was reading about tomorrow's march, in the newspaper, if you look at the hard copy, there was another article about a five or six-year-old girl, and I don't remember what state that she lives in, but
Colorado.
You know what I'm talking about. She had been forced by her school not to use the girls' bathroom, even though she identified as female. Her parents accepted that, and her parents won that case. That's a very young age, but I'm wondering, are we going to see with the rise of visibility of gay rights activism, also trans right cases like this?
Absolutely, and I think you're seeing more and more of them. One of the things that we know to be true is that trans people in general suffer a great deal of employment discrimination, for example, much larger than the percentage rates that are suffered by gay men or lesbians. And so a large number of the cases that we see relate specifically to employment discrimination. Certainly with young people, it becomes issues around access to resources at school, being treated fairly, not being bullied, having access to restrooms, those kinds of public accommodation issues related to young people being able to be successful in school.
Carolyn McGregor, I are you still with us?
Yes, I was going to say I could speak to that a little
bit. Yeah, I was going to ask you to speak to that. You have a child in school, and I'm wondering what her experience has been and what kinds of fights, if any, you have had to battle.
Correct. Well, until for the first K through 2 years of school, I actually had her at a very small private school where I was able to be very involved in their support of her, the teacher's support and the handling, and even be in dialogue with a lot of the parents. For third grade, we transferred her to Seattle Public Schools, and I found with much of my other parent peers in the support group around the area that you have to approach, and something has just changed, but prior to just this year, you have to approach each school, each principal, each teacher as an unknown and do the education. Ask for your needs to be met, basically asking, you know, can my child use the bathroom of the gender that they identify with? Can they have access to sports? Can they, you know, have equal treatment? And until this fall in Seattle, it was really an unknown how each principal was going to respond. But just this fall, we actually had Lisa Love, who works for the Seattle Public Schools, was able to put in place a policy for the school district that mirrors that of Washington State, so that the trans children can access the bathroom of the gender that they identify with, and that's just a given, and it shouldn't have to be a battle anymore in any given school, but that's just a district policy. So, you know, we're making strides every year. You know, my daughter was kind of in the mix of this because we had to work on it the prior year when it wasn't district policy yet, and say, you know, this is what the state says. Can't the school follow along?
Certainly, I think also in my instance, that was, for me in high school, the location of much of the harassment and
discrimination. The bathroom?
Was bathrooms, yeah, certainly. And that tends to be the place in which a lot of consternation happens. And where, like for me, I was bullied and targeted specifically in the bathroom because my school forced me to use a bathroom that didn't match with how I presented my gender.
You had to use the boys' bathroom,
yeah.
In other words.
Yeah.
Well, so
we certainly see that also on a legislative basis. I mean, we saw recently in Arizona a whole bathroom bill designed to prevent transgender people from using the restroom of their choice. We've seen that kind of...
Did that bill pass?
No, I think it ultimately failed. But we've seen that kind of baiting kind of language used over and over and over again. For example, in, I don't remember which city in Florida it is that had tried to pass a similar city ordinance. The concern always being couched in terms of safety of children to prevent those... terrible trans people from using the restroom. That kind of fear tactic is something that gets leveled at trans people fairly regularly and unabashedly, I think, by a large number of politicians.
So, Carolyn McGregor, I have a last question for you before we let you go, which is that you and your daughter will be in this march tomorrow. And if there was one thing that came out of it for you, what outcome would you like to see?
You know, I think really just the experience of being in this movement when so much change is happening, and having my daughter experience, you know, being a pioneer of sorts and being part of change, I think it's really a huge thing. And, you know, when I talk to her about the civil rights movement, that, you know, all the things that have happened throughout the history of our country, and the fact that, you know, who she is, she's still in a state where we're not a state, but, you know, a time when she is fighting to be authentic and to be recognized and treated equally. So we're really, you know, in the midst of change, and it's exciting, and it's, you know, a little bit scary sometimes, but I think it's just a really good place for her to be and see all the support around her and the other people that she, you know, is part of their community that she belongs with. And I think it's just a really exciting time.
Well, thank you so much for sharing part of your story with us, Carolyn McGregor, mother of an 11-year-old daughter, who will be, both of them, at tomorrow's march. And I have to ask, Daniela Schini, you could have picked any weekend for this to happen, but it's separate but adjacent to the Pride celebration. That was intentional, I assume.
Certainly, yeah. And so I think that it's a reflection of solidarity that we feel. I mean, many trans folks also identify as gay or lesbian or bi. And so we really wanted to follow the model that San Francisco has had, which is to have like one night that is the trans march, one night that is the dyke march, and then one day that is the LGBT pride parade. And so it's really about solidarity and recognizing our shared commitment to social justice as a community, and to ask gay and lesbian folks to show up for their trans brothers and sisters. And so really, we felt like this was the most strategic weekend to do it.
How many people are you expecting?
I have no idea. I mean, initially,
it
we...
It could just be us. Who knows?
Initially, we...
Well, there'll be four of you because Carolyn and her daughter will
be
there.
Exactly. Initially, we had thought like 250, but over the last month, the response has been incredible, including being on the cover of Seattle Times on Monday. So... I have no idea. I would guess 500 to 1,000 people, perhaps.
So, Spencer, I asked Carolyn for her and her daughter what would be a great outcome for you. What would be a great outcome of tomorrow's march or the weekend celebration?
Oh, there's so much to celebrate this weekend. It's been a really game-changing week.
Yes, it has.
And, you know, there's still so much work to be done. So I think for me the best outcome that I could see of this weekend is that we invigorate our community to take action on the things that still need to be done. Celebrate what we have to celebrate, celebrate all the wins that we have to celebrate, because there have been really significant wins, not just the DOMA case, but particularly for trans people. Social Security Administration just changed their policy to have a no surgical or medical treatment requirement. So it falls in line with the U.S. passport policy that was instituted 3 years ago. That's a huge, huge, huge win for trans people trying to access appropriate identification so that they can go to work in an unfettered way. So there's been huge wins, but there's still so much to do. So I really hope that this event tomorrow helps to crystallize the community and make them feel even more motivated to do the work that's ahead.
Now, I'm assuming, Danielle Eschini, that some of that work will fall onto your organization, Gender Justice League. So once you can breathe after this event tomorrow, what is next on your priority list?
Sure. Yeah. So I think that we're a membership-based organization, and we work collectively. We're very non-hierarchical. And so some of the things that our members have highlighted are looking at things like incarceration rates for trans women, or trans people in general, and working with folks who have been incarcerated, looking at issues of homelessness, looking at healthcare, educating healthcare providers. We're working with the University of Washington right now to institute a 12-week class in their medical school, but we hope to extend that beyond just UW Med School. We're going to be looking at healthcare exclusions and trying to take some action, as we've seen in Oregon recently. There's our list. It's very long. It's very long, but I'm excited. There's so many people have shown up in this last year, and I think this is the moment. People are ready to really be moving forward on some of these issues that have been left unaddressed for many years.
Danielle Eschini is executive director of the Gender Justice League, organizers of the Trans Pride March tomorrow. Spencer Bergstadt will be speaking. I'm sorry, I'm having speech difficulties today. He's a Seattle attorney, and I'm not sure if your practice deals solely in these issues, but
no, not at all.
Okay,
actually,
he'll take any case at all. The Trans Pride March is going to be held tomorrow evening on Capitol Hill in Seattle. I'm not sure exactly where you start, but you end at Cal Anderson Park.
We start in front of Seattle Central Community College, and we start marching at 6 p.m.
6 p.m. tomorrow evening. Thanks both of you for coming in today.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Stay put. Okay. And now, the sound of the day. Sounds like people snorting something, but in fact, it's the sound of coffee educators at Café Ladro tasting and evaluating coffee at Atlas Coffee Importers. It's called cupping. The sound is a slurping noise you make when you take a spoonful of coffee and aspirate it in your mouth for evaluation. It sounds very clinical. Our listener, Layla, sent us that sound. We'd love to hear from you. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds and send the sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org, and please include sound of the day in the subject line. Are you slurping in there, Bernard?
I'm aspirating my coffee.
Yes. Sounds wonderful. We've got more Weekday up ahead, including an interview about Nelson Mandela and the personal legacy he left with one South African man. This is Weekday.
$9.59, and in a moment here, we're going to get the latest on state budget talks and find out how a heavily used food program will be unavailable if lawmakers can't come to an agreement by Monday. That's in the news just ahead. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
The British soul singer Omar was a child musician back in the 70s. He's made his newest album the way he did it back then.
I've really tried to recreate that live sound and you know, playing with bands, and everybody's in one room and all playing together. There's nothing quite like that vibe.
I'm David Green, a conversation with Omar on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Nights at the Neptune, a series of events open to the public to be held at the Neptune Theater, running from June 25th to September 17th. Full series lineup and schedule available at stgpresents.org.
.66 degrees in Seattle with clouds and scattered showers. Expecting showers through the day, a high of 72. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.